The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 252, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. This week's episode is a replay of my interview with Jimmy Clegg about how he went from 500 pounds to now, I think, somewhere in the 290s, maybe even less. I'm seeing on social media more and more diet and food content. Carnivore this and vegan that, and it's easy to be discouraged about what's the right way to go. In my view, Jimmy is a walking testimony for returning to the basics of good eating, and that's why I want to share this again. Get back to the basics. There are two main parts to Jimmy's content, the keto part and the standard American diet part, and most of us know what that is and where it gets you. Now on to the episode.
Okay, today I'm talking with Jimmy Clegg about the keto diet, what it is, what it does, and does not do, and why does it seem to be necessary? We talk about the current American diet and the harm it has caused. Jimmy moderates the Keto AF parenthesis Ancestral and Fasting close parenthesis Facebook page, which is a closed group you can join by clicking on the join button. And I'll have the link to his Facebook page on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/11. Jimmy is also working on an ebook about his keto journey, and you can learn more about that book also in his keto Facebook group. Jimmy?
I'm here.
Cool. All right. So tell me a little bit about you and your journey into keto.
Well, about 6 years ago, I was 500 pounds. I was completely in denial. You know, the last time I weighed, I think I'd weighed 360 and had put on obviously a lot more weight. I was in total denial. And I got sick. I thought I had a stomach virus, and it lingered for, you know, a couple of weeks, and then it became a month. And finally, my wife recruited my sister and my mom, made me go to the doctor. I hadn't been to the doctor in years. And at that point, I'd already lost 40 or 50 pounds from being sick. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. At the time of going to the doctor, I had a blood pressure of around 200 over 130. Morbidly obese, of course. I had these lesions. I had to have IV antibiotics and came close to losing my leg, potentially. Because of infections due to the Crohn's disease. And I tell people that's when I hit rock bottom. My doctor was very candid with me and said, I was 40 at the time, and said, you're not going to live to be 50. You're not going to see 50 if at the rate you're going, something's got to change. And of course, the standard advice from a doctor is eat less and move more. A lot of people don't realize that doctors have absolutely zero nutritional training. I mean, they're very important and very good at what they do, but nutrition is not what they specialize in. So other than, you know, get yourself in shape and lose some weight, that's about all the advice that my doctor could give. Being the person I am, if I'm going to do something, if I'm going to change something, I want to know the mechanism and really do all of my research. So I just happened to come across, I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast, and I came across a guy named Mark Sisson, who's a kind of a paleo guy, but he had authored a book called The Primal Blueprint. And I listened to that podcast and I went and bought the book and read it, and it made so much sense. So I immediately went on a primal diet. And I lost from, you know, close to 500 down to about 360 and stalled out. During that time, I just continued my own personal research, my own personal self-experimentation. And I came across some podcasts, Jimmy Moore's podcast and the Two Keto Dudes podcast, and started really learning more about keto. I'd heard about the ketogenic diet, but I assumed it was the same thing as the Atkins diet that I'd done in the past. But once I started learning the details of the ketogenic diet, I realized that this is the next step that I need to take to help, you know, fix my broken metabolism. So, and here we are now. I've been doing keto around 3 years and reversed. I haven't had a Crohn's flare up since starting keto. I'm off the blood pressure medicines, healthier feeling and mentally than I have been in years. So, yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
All right. Well, that's an impressive testament. So, what is the keto diet? What does keto stand for? What does it mean?
Keto stands for the ketogenic diet. It was developed in the 1920s by the Mayo Clinic as a pretty much a cure for epilepsy. And it was kind of abandoned in the 50s when they came out with medication for epilepsy. Atkins kind of got the ball rolling again about ketosis. And then we've had 30 years of research or so now showing the benefits of the diet. But in essence, what you're doing is you're starving yourself, eating very low amounts of carbohydrates so that your body is forced to make its own energy. The standard American diet, we eat so many times a day and we eat such a high percentage of carbohydrates that we are constantly fueling ourselves with, you know, with glucose that is exogenous that we eat by starving ourselves. Starving is a bad word, but by depleting our glucose, we force our body to turn to alternative energy sources, which is the whole reason we store fat. So we literally break down our fat and use the lipids, and then our liver converts it to ketones, which is an alternative energy source, which is actually a much healthier energy source than glucose.
All right. So one of the things I think happens with pretty much any diet is obviously there will be detractors for everything, but you say it's healthier. So the question, two questions seem to come, is keto healthy? But then how does one define healthy?
That's a really good question. Keto is not necessary for everybody, but unfortunately, over half of the population has a condition called metabolic syndrome, the population of the United States. That is where we have, like I said, such high consumption of carbohydrates. When you consume carbohydrates, it's converted to glucose, your blood sugar goes up. You have beta receptors, cells that sense this, and they trigger your pancreas to produce insulin. Insulin's primary job is to store. It's a storage hormone. It's an anabolic storage hormone. So insulin's job is to take the sugar from the blood and either use it for energy or store it as fat. As insulin is elevated, you cannot lose weight. If insulin is triggered and insulin is high, your body must store, like I said, is anabolic. So the big problem is after decades of doing this, of having this high insulin, our body grows resistant to insulin. This resistance causes us to need more and more of it, which of course, eventually we're so resistant to the insulin that we can't control our blood sugar anymore. And that's, you know, at that point you're pre-diabetic and then diabetic. It starts with fatty liver disease, pre-diabetes, diabetes. It's kind of a vicious cycle. So what the ketogenic diet does is it restores, hopefully completely, but it restores our insulin sensitivity. If you're sensitive to insulin, if you're one of the fortunate people that are sensitive and to insulin, and resistant to this, then you can get away with a lot more carbohydrate consumption. But it's an epidemic. Diabetes is an epidemic. Pre-diabetes is an epidemic. And so the ketogenic diet is the best dietary intervention. And talking about healthy, it's always healthier to intervene naturally than to rely on medications. So as far as that's concerned, that's why the ketogenic diet is healthy. Ideally, we want to focus on whole foods and real food and get away from the processed food. And then you can enjoy higher carbohydrate foods, but they're whole. Sorry, my rooster's crowing in the background. But ideally, we don't want to be ketogenic forever. But myself, 30 years, 20 years at least, of metabolic damage, I may never be able to eat a decent amount of carbohydrates, and I'm fine with that. But that's the reason ketogenic diet is currently, I'm air quoting, healthy, with the epidemic of metabolic syndrome that we have in the United States.
That's interesting. I scanned your manuscript, and there are some interesting ideas that seem to be consistent with the things that I've read about keto, and still probably pretty controversial. I think one of the most notable things is the not eating carbs part, because we're, as you mentioned, doctors, I think as an industry, are probably well-meaning. I think that's part of being a doctor, is being well-meaning. But I also think there's probably a lot of either none or lack of information for the real important nutritional part. And we can get into conversations about the book, The Big Fat Surprise, and the at least faulty research methods of Keys. But that's another show. Is the whole basis for ketosis figuring out which of those carbs are bad carbs? So the question really is broccoli better than a pear?
Exactly. And there's a test you can do called a carb tolerance test, where you can actually, if you go buy a cheap glucose meter, you can go to any pharmacy and buy a stick of testing sticks. You can sample on yourself, fasted, eat a carbohydrate like a sweet potato, and test yourself 30 minutes later, an hour later, 2 hours later, and see how much that carb spikes your glucose and then how quickly you recover close to baseline. But one of the big things is some of the things that we've been told are healthy. Let's take fruit juice, for example. Your body does not know the difference between grape juice and Coca-Cola. All the good part of the grape, which is the meat of the grape, has in essence been stripped away, and just the sugar, grape-flavored sugar water remains. And so people are, downing orange juice, downing grape juice, apple juice in the morning, and thinking they're being healthy. The sugar in that juice is just concentrating so many apples. The other big thing is fructose, especially with fruits. Fructose, and the demonization of high fructose corn syrup, rightfully so, but the problem with fructose is one of the sugars that our body can do absolutely nothing with. Our small intestines may be able to absorb a little bit of it, but the bulk of it has to be metabolized in the liver. And the only thing your liver can do with it is turn it to fat. So you eat a banana, for instance. A banana, I believe, is around 41% fructose. So you eat a medium-sized banana, you're going to get 30 grams of fructose. It's going straight to your liver, and the only thing your liver can do with it is turn it into fat. Whereas if you eat a strawberry, it's lower fructose, a little more fiber in it. It's just healthier. So there's definitely a difference between a potato and an avocado and the effect it has on your body.
Is a banana one of those five foods never eat list fruits?
One thing you have to look at is anything you eat, as far as health is concerned, anything you eat, look at the calorie density of it. And we don't count calories, but we're aware of them. Look at the calorie density of that food and then what it contributed to you nutritionally, as far as micronutrients. So, you know, if you eat an avocado or an egg and an avocado are superfoods, very dense in micronutrients, whereas you could eat a potato and you get almost nothing but carbohydrate.
Interesting. So actually, back there was, I remember the time when the baked potato was hailed as this great thing to eat, and the horror of it all was adding the bacon and the cheese and the sour cream. It sounds to me like we should have the baked potato without the potato and have the sour cream and the bacon and the cheese and go for something like that.
Yeah, the irony of it is all of that you mentioned is the healthy part. You know, I actually wrote a blog post on our Facebook page about that subject. Like, if you eat a potato, I mean, how often do you boil some potatoes, don't season them, and just eat plain potato?
Seldom.
Seldom. Yeah, but what is it on the baked potato? The cheese, the chopped beef, whatever you put on it, the chives, the bacon bits, all sour cream, butter, all that. That's a baked potato and potato. The ketogenic, you know, our approach, we use foods like cauliflower, which are nutrient dense, spaghetti squash. You know, if you make a pot roast and you would normally cube potatoes and put in a pot roast, it's going to be hard to believe, but trust me, if you cut up radishes, cut them in half and put them in the pot roast in a slow cooker, however you're going to do it, you will not be able to tell the difference between a radish in a pot roast and a new potato. I mean, so we have alternatives to almost any of these unhealthy staples that, you know, dominate the standard American diet.
Well, the radish is an interesting idea, and I can conceive of how that works just from cooking them. I can't see that the spicy bit goes away entirely. And I'm thinking, well, my kids would eat pot roast anyway, but if they did, if I told them it was a radish, of course, that changes everything. When you know what it is, I'm not touching that. But it's an interesting idea. I might have to just try it and see if I can sneak one past them.
Hey, honestly, the spiciness almost completely goes away. You just have to, I don't know how many people in our group have been hesitant. And I said, just trust me on this, try it. And then they respond back to their amazement. And like I said, cauliflower, we use cauliflower. I mean, we make pizza crust out of cauliflower, bread out of cauliflower. We make this, we call it loaded cauliflower, but it's similar to a twice baked potato. And we actually took it to my wife's family's Thanksgiving gathering, and we didn't tell anybody it was ketogenic, it was low carb, and they thought it was twice baked potato. She actually had somebody tell her that they want to get the recipe for twice baked potatoes, and it was cauliflower, and there was almost very, very few carbohydrates in it.
Funny. It's clever. I like that, man. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions. I just want to play devil's advocate a little bit.
Okay.
How do you respond to, or what is the response to the person who wants only to lose weight and says keto is the way for me to go just to lose weight?
I would say it will work, definitely. But if they have the mindset that, like I told you before, this metabolic syndrome is a cumulative disease that generally takes decades to manifest. So if you just want to do keto to lose weight, it's going to work. But if you think you can go back to the standard American or the Western diet after you lose that weight, and it's a lifestyle. We really hate the word diet, honestly. It's truly a lifestyle. Now, like I said earlier, hopefully we can graduate to more of a primal paleolithic type of diet, but still focused on whole foods. So yeah, I'm very skeptical and I'm very cautious dealing with people that I coach on just weight loss. As a matter of fact, I tell our people to weigh once a month if they can make themselves, and judge by measurements, because especially in women, I had a lady the other day that admitted she'd only lost 3 pounds in 60 days and was ready to quit the diet. And after a little, the diet, I just said diet, lifestyle, after a little talking with her and getting more information, she admitted to losing 5 pant sizes. She went from I can't remember, it was like a 12 to an 8 or something like that. But and I asked her, had she been measuring? And she said no. And I said, it's just, you know, it's total body composition, and that we're worried about. What the scale says is very deceiving, especially if you're obese. You can fluctuate anywhere from 3 to 10 pounds a day just from water retention. So I really don't like people only focusing on weight loss. It's really health span, not lifespan, but health span, and just longevity that in general that we're interested in. I tell people all the time, I could care less what you look like in a swimsuit. I would love, yeah, I tell people all the time myself, I want to die at 100 years old in a skydiving accident or rock climbing. I don't want to, you know, spend the last 20 years of my life bedridden or in a wheelchair.
Well, dying from a skydiving accident sounds terrifying. I understand the idea of dying being an active individual as opposed to being a, well, let's just go ahead and make the joke, a couch potato.
Exactly.
One more devil's advocate question, and we're going to pick on the medical profession a little bit. I have read posts, not necessarily in your group, but in general, you know, people in other chef groups I'm in talking about the various low-carb, high-protein diets, and a lot of almost knee-jerk responses are, well, my doctor said too much fat's bad for me. And also, combined with that, too much meat is bad for me. I have seen plenty of information that contradicts that, but we have a problem. We have lots of resources available, both online and in print, or we have the person with the sheepskin on the wall saying, don't do this. So it's a real challenge to me to decide which information is right. We have the doctor we're told to trust, and probably we should, because the doctor has specialized knowledge that I don't have about certain parts of how the body works. I don't know these things, but then there are areas of medical opinion, and it seems that diet is one of them, where they haven't moved from the position of which we were told as kids. You know, don't eat bacon, don't eat fat, eat vegetables, eat vegetable oils, which we're going to talk about in a minute. I guess there's the question, how does one determine which information is the sound, right information?
One of my favorite sayings is, show me the science. So you really need to, you know, people will put these, somebody shared a post in our group the other day, and it said something along the lines of, studies show that fast food is healthier for you than bacon or something like that. And it ended up being a very good article, but the title was clickbait. And I think some of the big problems we have with society now is nobody takes the time to look at the research. They see an article on a scientific study and just read the one sentence that they use as clickbait for the title, and then they make a judgment on, you know, like, go with it. Like, I had somebody quit keto a few months ago because of that. I believe it was the scaremongering that came out about coconut oil, and so, like, well, I'm not going to do keto anymore. It looks like I'm going to be going Mediterranean or something like that. And, you know, didn't even read the article, didn't look at the the actual research. And that's one of the reasons I wrote Journey to the Center of the Girth, is because, you know, just me being the way I'm wired, I have to know why on everything. I'm not going to do anything without having some basic understanding. So I just assumed that everybody else was like that. And then when I start coaching and helping people, I find out 90% of people just want to be told what to do. They're not going to take the time to read any research. So that's why I wrote the book very much in layman's terms. And not that I'm a scientist or anything, but, you know, I do the studying, and I know, and I try to relay it quick enough. That's why I did an ebook format. It's only maybe a 30-minute read, front to back, so that it's quick hitting and gives you the basic principles, and then hopefully gets you going, and then hopefully you will evolve in the diet and learn more as you go. But one of the other things, going back to your question, is I think it's unfortunate that there's kind of the paleo, the vegan, the vegetarian, now the carnivore movement, and they all seem to be pitted against each other. The truth is, any of those are night and day better than the standard American diet that has caused this epidemic. Any of those are. And, you know, going back to me being a libertarian, as yourself, from what I understand, it enrages me that our government, you know, had something to do with this, that lobbyists and corruption was involved in the food guidelines that it's caused an epidemic. And honestly, it really hits home to me because my mom passed away in May of this year from complications from diabetes and kidney failure. And it was totally avoidable, but she did what she was told. She did what she thought was healthy, and it killed her. And I was going down that same path myself until I intervened. And so if somebody wants to be a vegetarian, if it gets them off of the, you know, if that gets them off of the standard diet, the Jack in the Box and the McDonald's, you know, then go for it. It's night and day different. And the truth is, as far as nutrition is concerned, we're in the infancy of research. We just now, in the last 30 or 40 years, have the capability to really start understanding stuff like the gut biome. People don't realize that 80% of your hormones are created in your gut by bacteria, not even your own body. That the human body has 10 times more bacteria than it has human cells. That your brain, the hormones that regulate your brain and your cognitive function and your, you know, depression, anxiety, and stuff like that can directly be affected by your gut biome. It's called the gut-brain axis. We're just in the infancy of understanding this stuff. So it's unfortunate that all of these different camps, like paleo, like vegan, are pitted against each other, when in fact, any of them are night and day better than the standard American diet.
And the standard American diet, I would add, you cleverly acronymed SAD.
Right. That wasn't me, but it is.
Oh, well, I chuckled nonetheless. I thought that was funny. So in your book, you have the Ten Commandments.
Yes, sir.
And one of them was particularly interesting because it seems to be the most, I'm going to say controversial again, only in the sense that it goes against conventional wisdom and what we're being told mostly by even things like the Mediterranean diet and other diets is, and the commandment is this, no vegetable oil.
Exactly.
That's a bold thing to say, so tell me why.
Well, first of all, can you name a vegetable oil? I hate to answer your question with a question, but can you name a vegetable oil?
Well, I would assume corn oil is a vegetable oil. Canola is a seed. That's not a vegetable.
What is corn?
It's actually a grain.
Yeah, corn is a grain. So the mislabeling is the word vegetable oil. Vegetable oils are actually grain oils. If you look at some of Nina Teicholz's work, I think you mentioned one of her books earlier.
Yeah, I'm reading it.
It's hard to believe, but and my dates may be a year or two off, but I believe the first documented fatal heart attack in the United States was in 1911. it's hard to believe that just about a century ago, as prevalent as heart attacks and death by heart disease is now, that just a little over 100 years ago was the first ever documented fatal heart attack. Coincidentally, a year before that, vegetable oil was invented. It was the cotton boom, and they had all these cotton seeds at the cotton gins, and somebody figured out you could press them and use this oil. And then, of course, that evolved into corn oil, which is way cheaper. And you can look at the parallel, and Nina Cox does a really good job of it, drafting it. But you can look at the parallel between the invention of vegetable oil and the skyrocketing heart disease. And maybe I don't know her name offhand, but one of the leading scientists in the world came out in the last year and said that you would be better off drinking liquid radiation than consuming vegetable oil. It's just inflammatory. I mean, it's like, especially grains in general, we avoid all grains, but vegetable oil is just unbelievably inflammatory. And, you know, I tell people all the time, if you consume something that inflames you, like if you can feel your fingers swollen or maybe your knees, or you just feel stiff after eating something like that, you have to realize that your fingers being stiff is just what you can see on the outside. Your brain, your lungs, your heart, your blood vessels, everything is inflamed. It's an autoimmune reaction, or it's a immune reaction your body's setting up to the grains. So, I mean, that's another one we could go into a whole show on, the dangers of vegetable oil.
Well, that's more of an answer than I expected, and so I appreciate that. I want to hit the medical profession one more time. Do you think the doctors are, and this is totally conjecture, and I apologize for the unfairness of the question, but you might have some insight. Do you think doctors are under-recommending or actively dissuading the keto diet because they have a vested interest in ignoring it?
That's really tough. I would like to believe that as far as the practitioners are concerned, that there's no monetary, nothing affecting their decisions. I believe they've just been taught. And, you know, part of the big problem is the medical profession. You know, the modern medicine at the turn of in the 1900s, the vast majority of cases doctors saw were acute infectious diseases. Through science, thank God, we've cured almost all of these acute infectious diseases. But the system is built on treating acute diseases. So if you didn't have a cure for a viral pneumonia, you would treat the symptoms. And I think today we're dealing with an epidemic of chronic diseases. We've cured almost all the acute diseases, but now we're dealing with chronic diseases like diabetes. Diabetes is a disease of insulin resistance, not a disease of high blood sugar. High blood sugar is the symptom caused by our body not responding to insulin anymore. How do we treat it? We give people more insulin. The whole reason we're insulin resistant is because we've overproduced and burn out our beta receptors on insulin. So we're actually treating the problem of diabetes, treating the disease with the problem. That's why when people get on insulin, they have to go higher and higher and higher and never get off, because we're the whole thing that causes the condition to start with, we're contributing to it with. So doctors, my point is, doctors nowadays still treat chronic diseases as if they're an acute disease. And I believe with the rampant, you know, corruption and in the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and their liability, and now all the lawsuits and the liability that the doctors have to face, the insurance they have to pay, the co-pays, the franchise fees, doctors have to take on these enormous patient loads, you know, just to make the lifestyle they want to live, which, you know, and I believe Chris Kesser, is a functional medicine doctor. He's written a he wrote a book called Unconventional Medicine that's amazing. I recommend everybody read it. But he talks about the average doctor visit now is 10 minutes. And something like 7 minutes of that is introduction and getting a background and the doctor asking a few questions. And only 3 minutes is actually, you know, getting to the nuts and bolts of the problem. And it's not the doctor's fault. So I don't think that I don't think on the practitioner's part that it's anything as far as corruption or anything like that. I think the whole system's broken. And I think the doctors, you think if you have an enormous patient load, you only get 10 minutes of patients, you're working, you know, you're on call at the hospital, you know, plus your clinical practice, your practice and the little bit of time you have as far as continuing education, most of them can't afford to go to seminar, or they can afford, but they don't have the time to go to seminars and continue education. So they get most of their material from pharmaceutical companies as pamphlets. And we know they don't have our interest in mind, our best interest in mind. So, yeah, you know, I don't blame the doctor. It's really a pet peeve. I actually have a couple of doctors that I deal with now that are ketogenic, and they'll be the first to tell you my one pretty good friend who's a doctor said he, you know, through all of his medical training, he remembers one lecture where they touched on nutrition for maybe half an hour, and it was more of the move more, eat less type of thing. Plus anybody, any business or any individual that gets any funding from the FDA has to follow government guidelines. They have no choice. So any nutritionist, dietitian that gets any of their funding or grants from the FDA have to follow. They can't buck the guidelines. So maybe that answers your question.
With the holidays upcoming, how can they who are or wish to be keto get through this holiday party season with some sanity?
That's a good question. We, first of all, and this is kind of controversial in the keto community because it's divided, but, and I don't know of any scientific evidence, but it makes sense to me that our bodies adapt extremely well, and that's a fact. I think if we stay on any program strictly without deviation, our body is eventually going to adapt to it. Like I lift weights, and lifting weights is actually tearing your muscles, micro tears, and then they grow back or repair themselves stronger. I believe if, as much as I love the ketogenic diet, if you never deviate, then your body will probably adapt to it and, you know, you will plateau or have trouble reaching your goals. So I honestly believe cheating strategically and occasionally is a good thing. So I actually encourage our people in our group, go ahead and take the day off. Don't let that meal at Christmas turn into a week. And so you have to do a little soul searching and see if you are able to take a cheap meal or a cheap day and then jump right back on the wagon. But also we, you know, my wife and I, we started out for a couple of our people in our group. I started out making these tortillas. I took a crepe recipe and you pretty much give up bread with the ketogenic diet. But I love tortillas, so I would buy the CarbSense tortillas at the store. But I noticed they would inflame me. My fingers, because of my Crohn's disease, I have this kind of rare arthritis that is usually gone, but it can be triggered. And these tortillas would trigger it, and my fingers would get sore, and my toes would get sore. And I look at the ingredients one day, and there's 3 kinds of gluten in these things. And then it was just all wheat byproducts. It was all grain-based byproducts that they had refined heavily. So I started messing around, and I converted a crepe recipe into tortillas. And I posted pictures of them. A couple people asked if I would make them some. And then from that, it sprang into you know, our wife and I kind of a side project besides our regular job. So we make Fat Bombs, ketogenic versions of barbecue sauce. For Thanksgiving, we made pecan pies, pumpkin pies. We make fudge, brittle, working on spaghetti sauce. We do spiced nuts, sweet and spicy nuts, just a variety, and really a big variety of Fat Bombs. And so these sweeteners, the natural sweeteners we use, we try to stay away from, you know, artificial sweeteners. But the natural sugar alternatives like xylitol and erythritol, stevia, sometimes, you can really, I mean, a lot of the recipes, like just simple peanut butter cookies, you know, the only thing in there that's not really ketogenic is the sugar. You substitute that with xylitol and you can use the exact same recipe. So we've been really successful taking traditional recipes and, you know, if it calls for wheat flour, we might use super fine almond flour and, of course, substitute erythritol or xylitol for the sugar. And, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but we've came up with some really good recipes. And plus Pinterest, and there's a, my wife loves a website called All Day I Dream About Food. There's a up close to your area, a classically trained pastry chef from England. Her name is Carrie Brown, and I think she lives really close to you, honestly. She does several cookbooks. She's specifically keto now, and she's and then Maria Emmerich. There's a lot of really prominent keto cooks now that are out there, and so you can, as I touched on earlier, with the loaded cauliflower and spaghetti squash and stuff like that, we, you know, we make keto dishes that are clones of the, you know, the unhealthy stuff that we would have eaten in the past that are as good or better.
The almond flour is a good idea. I like that idea because I love almond flour and I've used it in flourless chocolate cakes. And it works out well. That's a smart move.
Yeah, and we do things like lasagna. Everything in lasagna is ketogenic except for the noodles. We will slice zucchini, or we will use there's this amazing recipe called Fathead Pizza Dough. And it's since Fathead Pizza came out, people have changed the base recipe for the dough. You can make cinnamon rolls, you can make noodles, you can make Cheddar Bay biscuits, identical to the ones you get at Red Lobster. I mean, it's just, there's a few staples of the ketogenic diet that are just so versatile, like a cauliflower I mentioned, fathead dough. They're so versatile and make the food, you know, make the selection and the variety of the food really appealing now. There's no reason. It's no longer, people think of ketogenic as Atkins, as just eating bacon and eggs all day. It's nothing like that now, as you could probably tell by the recipes in our group.
Is there something that you would endorse? Is there a product that you, or an author that you know of that would be somebody that you would be willing to say, yes, if you are interested in getting into some kind of a program with a structured routine to help, is there somebody you say this is a good person to recommend?
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of resources that I recommend. One of my absolute favorites is by a doctor named Dr. Jason Fung from Toronto, Canada. He's really not a ketogenic specialist, but he's a diabetic doctor, and he's having phenomenal results reversing diabetes in thousands of people. He wrote a book called The Obesity Code and another book called The Diabetes Code, and they really delve deep into the mechanisms that cause diabetes and the epidemic that's going on with it. There's also another book called Keto Clarity by Jimmy Moore. A ton of podcasts. Jimmy Moore has several podcasts, Living La Vida Low Carb, Keto Hacker MD, Keto Talk. There's a podcast called Two Keto Dudes. There's an excellent podcast. Just tons and tons of resources.
Well, I appreciate your time. And before I let you go, I'm trying something new on this episode, and I'm stealing an idea from Nikki P at Sounds Like Liberty Podcast and James Lipton's The Actors Studio. So if you're familiar with either of those, you sort of have an idea what's coming. I've changed them to be consistent with a food podcast. So, Jimmy, what's your favorite food?
My favorite food would be porterhouse steak.
Oh, all right. What's your least favorite food?
Oh, man. Wow. Least favorite. Well, first of all, I'm a 6'5", 300-pound guy, and at one point I was 500 pounds, so there's not many foods I didn't like. But I would say, like, spinach. Although I like spinach and like, dips and stuff, it's spinach, collard greens, any of those leafy greens that are wilted and slimy when cooked.
What gets you excited?
Food-wise?
Sure.
Or just in general?
You pick.
Food-wise, I try to get the mentality where I don't get excited anymore, because I think part of the problem is food is thought of as entertainment, which is nothing wrong with that, but everyday entertainment, that's where we get into a problem instead of it being nourishment. But as far as in life now, I really get excited seeing people. Our group is around 5,000 members now, and there are some really big names in the ketogenic world that are making a huge influence. But the fact that, in essence, what we're telling people is to eat real food, to not eat as much, to be a little more active, and to take charge of their own health, makes it really hard for the ketogenic research to get funded, because, you know, people take control of their own health. They're not dependent on pharmaceuticals or, you know, big sugar or, you know, any of those companies. So they stand to lose. Most of these, the research that is done now is funded by companies like pharmaceutical companies. So it gets me excited to do my small part, even though it's just a few thousand people. But, you know, every time somebody messages me and says they've lost some weight, or they're, you know, we've had a couple of dozen now that have totally reversed their diabetes. And knowing that I was too late to help my mom, but seeing us influence people and people change their lives for the better and then pay it forward, that's all we never charge for any coaching. Just seeing, all we ask is pay it forward. Now that you've taken control of your health or on your way to taking control of your health, pay it forward, you know, share your knowledge with somebody else. And seeing that come to fruition is, you know, it's what excites me now.
What makes you turn off?
Makes me turn off political arguments. I see it on Facebook all the time, the Democrat versus Republican, and just I see all these people that have a lot of common ground that are just fighting against each other because of a fictional political party that doesn't really, neither one of them care about them, that left their base a long time ago. So seeing people that I know, everybody's a badass on Facebook, but you know, seeing people tear into each other when really they've got a lot of common and they have a lot of the same moral quality, but because one's labeled as a Republican and one labeled as a Democrat, and I thought after this midterm election that it would subside, but it's still going strong, and just it turns me off. I fume when I see it. And, you know, I don't know if you've looked at my Facebook page, I kind of throw jabs both ways just to mess with them because it's fun.
What sound do you love?
Sound do I love? This is going to be goofy, but I love the sound of spring. I live in Texas, so a thunderstorm, just the sound of a storm rolling in.
Oh, that's a good sound. What sound do you hate?
I don't know if it's a specific sound, but just your typical, any sound that contributes to like a noise pollution, just industrial, unnecessary, you know. Being a Texas guy, a deer hunt. And I've deer hunted since I was preteen. And we used to sit in the woods. And I guess I could say one of my favorite sounds is just silence. you know, and that's what you, we know back in the early 80s, late 70s, that's what you did when you sat in the woods. But now it's, you hear dogs barking, you hear cars, you hear oil derricks, there's beeping. And when you think you're in an isolated area, there's always something. And it's just, you never can just completely unwind, it seems like.
And what is your favorite food indulgence?
Favorite food indulgence. Honestly, I've changed over the, I mean, it would have been 20 years ago, it would have been sweet food. Man, I would, even though it's ketogenic, I go back to steak. I can, the argument is, what is more satiating, fat or protein? And a lot of people say protein is really satiating, but I promise you, I could eat 3 pounds of porterhouse steak or ribeye. I'll just, if you keep it in front of me, I'll keep eating it, which isn't necessarily a good thing.
Well, you know, I understand the feeling. I feel that way about lots of desserts. I am an admitted deep sweet tooth, and so I know what my problems are. I just have to face them.
Exactly. Well, hey, I've got one more thing. I mentioned Chris Kesser earlier in his book, Unconventional Medicine. I really want to bring up, you know, in politics, we never hear nutrition and the diabetes, Alzheimer's epidemic. By the way, Alzheimer's is type 3 diabetes, but we never hear this brought up as a main topic. But you can reference Chris Kessler's book, Unconventional Medicine. Over half, there's 350 million people in the United States. Over 110 million, so roughly 33%, are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. And then over half have metabolic syndrome, which is the precursor to prediabetes. The average diabetic costs $14,000 per year to treat. When this epidemic comes to fruition, it will bankrupt the country. You multiply $14,000 per year times 110 million people, you'll understand the problem that's ahead of us. And I believe in his book, we're talking around 2050, when this comes to be, if something doesn't happen. I don't know why. I mean, I know why, but it's not a big topic, but it needs to be. And Alzheimer's is right on diabetes' tail. And of course, we know what heart disease and cancer, and they're all linked. They're all inflammatory diseases, and they're all linked to each other. And this is a global crisis now, and nobody seems to talk about it. So something's got to be done.
Well, I think you're right about that, and I don't think politics and politicians are going to fix that for us.
Not as long as there's money involved. I apologize for the rooster, by the way. I don't know how hard he's coming through, but that's part of my having good quality eggs. That's the sacrifice I have to make.
It's, you know what? I don't mind it at all. It's a level of authenticity you just can't fake. Alrighty. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And go give the rooster a hug.
Thank you. Have a good one. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. That's going to do it. Jimmy's Keto AF page has a new name. It's called The Keto Lifestyle. I'll add a link to episode 11 on the show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/252. That page has all of the associated links, or at least most of them, relative to the first appearance, the original appearance, and also a link to their Facebook page. Everything should be back to normal for next week. It's a hot, muggy, well, it's not muggy here, but it's a hot August, and we'll get through it. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.